Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As the world watched in horror as the Asian tsunami death toll topped 150,000, global development guru Jeffrey Sachs was finishing work on a comprehensive plan to better prepare for such disasters and to eradicate hunger and poverty, to achieve universal primary education around the world, to reduce child mortality, to combat disease, to ensure environmental sustainability, all by the year 2015. Sachs is director of the UN's Millennium Project, launched to save the struggling bottom tier of humanity. He's especially focused on Africa, which he says is trapped by poverty, by climate, geography, debt, and disease. The third world needs a gusher of foreign aid, a big push, he says, to save it and the first world from disaster. On Monday, he will present his ambitious plan to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Tonight, On Point, Jeffrey Sachs, and a desperate, daring, grand strategy to conquer global poverty. You can join the conversation. After shelling out for tsunami relief, are you ready to dig deeper for Africa and the rest of the third world? And after half a century of aid, is more aid, much more aid, the answer? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Jeffrey Sachs. He is Special Advisor to Secretary General Kofi Annan on the Millennium Project, an initiative to meet development goals defined by world leaders at the UN Millennium Summit in New York City in 2000. He's also Director of Columbia University's Earth Institute and has advised governments in Latin America, Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, Asia, and Africa. His forthcoming book is The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time. Welcome to On Point, Jeffrey Sachs.
Thank you so much, Tom. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. You're just back from Africa. You've been there while the rest of the world was looking at the Indian Ocean, Southeast and South Asia. What thoughts of the contrast between that disaster and the global response to it and what you've seen for years in Africa? What's been brought to your mind, Jeffrey Sachs?
Well, I think the overwhelming sense, of course, was the horror and tragedy in Asia, but also the sense that there is an ongoing silent tsunami that grips Africa and that takes as many lives of African children every month silently below the radar screen, not in the media, as occurred in this disaster in Asia. And the silent tsunami in Africa has the added feature that it's utterly predictable. It's actually utterly solvable, and yet we're not solving it.
On Monday, you're going to step up with Kofi Annan and lay out a proposal for solving it. By the year 2015, if I understand it correctly, how on earth do you begin to do that? 10 years, Jeffrey Sachs.
I think the first thing to stress is that this isn't my proposal in the sense that it's not an outlandish, strange, weird call for some miraculous solution to problems. What the Secretary General asked me and a team of more than 250 specialists working in recent years to do was to come up with practical approaches for what the world leaders themselves endorsed and called for 5 years ago at the start of the new millennium. Mm-hmm. These are goals that the world has set. These are goals that the world has confirmed and reconfirmed again, the so-called Millennium Development Goals, to cut extreme poverty by half or more by the year 2015. But it's not happening, despite the promises and the commitments that have been made. The Secretary General asked me to lead a team to figure out why it's not happening. And our basic finding is it's not happening because we're not following through on the very things we said we would follow through on. The idea of more aid, again, is not my idea. This is a commitment that the United States and other governments made in Monterrey, Mexico, at an international conference in March 2002. We just haven't followed through on it.
And so, but it's not just why it hasn't worked that you're going to be laying out. You're going to be laying out a plan to make it work with some hugely ambitious goals. I mean, cutting poverty by half, as if that weren't enough, tackling disease, making primary education universal, expanding secondary, financing urban development, mobilizing science, gender equality, regional integration,
It sounds pretty daunting. It sounds pretty unrealistic, except that the pieces actually fit together. This is not just a wish list of wonderful things to do, although it is wonderful things to do, but actually improving health will help the education process. Children that are well-fed go to school and perform well in school. Providing safe drinking water helps to keep children healthy. Providing enough crops, which is one of the goals to cut hunger, helps to fight against disease. So the idea of these interlinked goals that were announced in the Millennium Assembly and adopted by all the world's leaders actually have a coherence to them because each one helps the other. And what we lay out and what we subtitle our report, Investing in Development, is a practical plan to achieve the Millennium Development Goals. The idea is really to get down into the nitty-gritty. So what do you mean? How do you actually do it? What are the priorities? And what we found is that in area after area, there are very straightforward, proven things that can be done at low cost that not only would save millions of lives, Tom, every year, but are well within the budget that we and the other rich countries have set for themselves to actually carry out this process.
We want to look at the budget. We want to get into that nitty-gritty. But let me just ask you first, if I may, how do you describe the stakes here? You say it's a silent tsunami. It goes on and on. And yet, you know, most people around the world go right on living as that tsunami you describe in Africa takes its toll. So I'm not sure the stakes are clear to people. The human suffering, it's there, but we're very well practiced at this point in turning a blind eye to it. How do you describe the stakes in a way that wakes people up to it?
Well, I don't know about waking people up to it, I have to say, because while life does go on, life is also lost. And just this weekend, I was in clinics and hospitals seeing people dying before my eyes, dying because there wasn't a pill available to keep them alive. And those pills are available in the world. They just happen not to be available in the ward. So I saw a mother of young children and her last breaths for absolutely no reason. I saw a ward of children with cerebral malaria, actually three children to a bed. The hospital was so overcrowded with the dying children. It makes no sense, because for the most modest investments, these problems could be solved. Now, yes, the stakes are beyond survival, and I think you're asking me, what does it mean for us? First, it means for us whether we value human life, and clearly Americans do. They respond to the tragedies. I think they're maybe benumbed, but I think more likely don't realize how much could be accomplished at such low cost. But what's also true in very practical ways, a continent fulminant with disease, with instability, with hunger, comes back to haunt us in so many ways. These are countries where we get enmeshed in the violence, where there are staging areas for terror. This is not hypothetical. This is actual fact, whether it's in Somalia or in unstable places in West Africa. We end up paying a mighty toll for the lack of focus on the small measures of prevention that could really change the situation.
So let's talk about what this would cost, Jeffrey Sachs. You say a modest investment, the headline I've read recently is $150 billion per year. It sounds like a lot of money. What's the price tag for this enormous step forward? Exciting if it could be accomplished. My gosh, what a difference in the world. But in 10 years, $150 billion times 10, is that the down payment?
Well, let me be clear, first of all, that big headline number, and we'll be releasing all of the detailed calculations on Monday. Mm-hmm. But generally, what we're saying is the following. We should understand how rich the rich world is. The United States is a $12 trillion economy now. When we talk about various programs and the debates over whether it's Social Security or healthcare or other things, we deal in trillions of dollars these days, not just the billions of dollars. That may sound a little bit flippant of me, but that's what it means to have a $12 trillion economy. the rich world as a whole, which is the United States, Europe, and Japan, is a $30 trillion economy right now. So when one talks about numbers, say, of $150 billion, and that's in the order that we're talking about with a lot of details, Tom, to be filled in, that's less. That's around a half of 1% of the income of the rich world. That's talking about 50 cents out of every $100 of income. So numbers that sound absolutely enormous when shared over the whole rich world are actually extraordinarily modest contributions to result in fantastic gains of saving millions of lives and, more than that, helping people really escape from poverty so they're not dependent on this kind of aid in the future. We're not talking about this kind of aid forever. We're talking about making the investments so that the poor actually get out of the rut. Instead, what we do is we wait till disaster hits, till the famine, till the hunger, whatever, and then we respond generously, and then a year or two later, there's another disaster, and people ask, well, why do we keep doing this? And the answer is because we don't focus on what could actually solve the problem, only on treating the symptoms.
Okay,
we're saying, let's solve the problem.
So many issues raised here, and we want to get to them. But I guess the first thing is I would like to really understand in broad terms the claim you're making, Jeffrey Sachs. You've worked in countries around the world. Now you've got kind of the whole world that you're looking at. If that investment were made, $150 billion a year roughly, I know the details are coming. If that were made, what are you claiming could be accomplished by 2015?
Here's the claim. Most of the world is not in extreme poverty, the kind of poverty that kills people because they can't afford to stay alive. But about a sixth of the world is in extreme poverty, about a billion people out of 6 billion on the planet. In the 21st century, nobody has to be in that kind of utterly extreme poverty. The world committed 5 years ago to reduce that rate of extreme poverty by at least half. I'm claiming we could eliminate it entirely by the year 2025, and indeed achieve the goal that was set to reduce it by half by the year 2015. Economic development, in fact, works. That's the beauty of the message. China, India, and others, they're on their way to economic development. A large part of Africa is not. We could help Africa get onto that path. We could help impoverished countries in our own hemisphere in Central America and the Andes also escape from extreme poverty. The claim is therefore not that everybody's going to be rich, that there's a miracle to spread our kind of prosperity over the whole world in a short period of time. No, the claim is that the extreme poverty on our planet has no place in the 21st century, and by targeted, well-thought-out, proven interventions, this kind of extreme poverty could be brought to a close by our generation.
And you know, people say, but Jeffrey, we've been giving aid since 1950, fill in the blank, and it hasn't happened. So what's the difference going to be this time? Is it simply in the scale of aid that you're proposing? Are you proposing such a huge gusher that it would somehow overwhelm all the, you know, all the detours and blind alleys and successes that aid has run into in the past?
Well, that's what the first thing I was going to say is that it's a little bit more complicated because, first, a lot of aid has worked. And that's why we're down to about a sixth of the world in this kind of extreme duress. You look back 30 or 40 years ago, there was a much larger proportion of the world in extreme poverty. But by economic development and well-directed assistance, a large part of the world actually got out of the rut.
But China didn't get out of the rut on the back of aid.
Well, China actually did have, by the way, a lot of aid, but China also doesn't have some of the barriers to development that those countries still in the rut do have. So there is no single diagnosis nor any single recipe for different countries in the world. China doesn't have the problem of the kind of drought-ridden, tropical, rain-fed agriculture that keeps Africa so hungry. China is a temperate zone country with irrigation-led agriculture. Therefore, they had a green revolution 30 years ago. Africa, which doesn't have irrigation, didn't. So you have to diagnose each circumstance in its own conditions. But another part of our aid is that a lot of our aid is just given for geopolitical reasons, not for development. We're saying focus on the real development challenge.
Jeffrey Sachs, we've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. Much more we want to hear. We're talking tonight about a daring grand strategy for ending extreme global poverty. You can join the conversation after shelling out for tsunami relief. Are you ready to dig deeper for a long time? For Africa and the rest of the third world, 1-800-423-8255 is the number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a daring grand strategy for ending extreme global poverty, one its creators swear will finally work. With global development evangelist Jeffrey Sachs, he is a special advisor to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. On Monday, they will be unveiling the so-called Millennium Project, how it will work, going after cutting extreme poverty in half by the year 2015, and Jeffrey Sachs says maybe by 2025, eliminating extreme poverty from the face of the earth. He's director of Columbia University's Earth Institute and joins me tonight from New York. You can join the conversation as well. After half a century of aid, do you still believe in aid as an answer to poverty? And what's worse, risking some wasted aid or risking a continental meltdown and dire global consequences? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeffrey Sachs, I know you've been asked this a million times, but it always comes up. I can see it coming up in the questions on my screen here in the studio right now. What about take Africa's governance at the national level? And people say, you know what, the stories we hear are about Swiss bank accounts and wasted money, and you're going to take another $150 billion a year and pour it in there and come out with what?
First, let me finish the thought about why the aid hasn't solved the problem. The aid we give to Africa as opposed to, say, the Middle East or some other geopolitical hotspots. The aid we give to Africa has been about $1 billion per year. That comes out to about $1.50 or $1.75 per African per year. Mm. Most of that is actually emergency food relief or consultants' fees from the United States. It's not surprising that not a lot has been left on the ground, in fact, because the level of effort has been so small for so long, we haven't gotten down to the practicalities. Now, the other point that I would stress about Africa in particular is that sub-Saharan Africa, this epicenter of the extreme poverty on the planet, is actually 49 countries. A lot of them I wouldn't recommend giving more aid to right now. They're very poorly governed. They're not capable of using it or us being sure that they're going to use it effectively. But there are a lot of very well-governed countries in Africa, especially well-governed given the extreme poverty and therefore the lack of computerization and telecommunications and so forth.
What percentage of the 49? Half well-governed enough to really use the aid, more or less?
Well, I'd say absolutely safely at least a quarter of the countries and probably a quarter to a third right away. And when the others see that we're finally getting started really helping those that are well-governed, the others are going to improve their performance as well. The fact of the matter is we complain a lot about Africa's governance as if there was one country and one problem.
Yep.
But when governments are doing an excellent job, take Ghana, which just had its multi-party democratic election, the president, very popular, was reelected. We're not helping that country either.
So, but you're saying when you aim the fire hose at those countries where things can work, will work, it will create political change in the other ill-governed countries quickly enough that they can get on this train and have a hope of meeting this 2015 poverty cut?
Well, I must say first, my most urgent sense and where I feel the most crying need is to help those countries that are ready to help themselves, where we've told them, make plans, do this, do that. They've done it. And then we still don't respond. So we're not even differentiating between the well-governed and the poorly governed countries in terms of real scale of aid at this point. If we were already responding to the well-governed countries, well, then it would be a more complicated argument. But we haven't even started that process effectively. Now, I do believe that many others would join in, or we'd recognize that often what we call weak governance isn't a matter of volition and stealing and corruption, but it's a matter of having an inability to hire skilled managers to keep skilled people on the payroll because the impoverishment is so great. the brain drain is so great that those with skills and degrees have left the country. And one of the things we're proposing is to help pay a salary which can actually keep a doctor in country rather than having Africa's doctors working in London or Detroit or Toronto or Riyadh, which is where so many of them work right now.
I want to come back to this Asia-Africa comparison, contrast, because I haven't been able to shake the kind of gross feeling that part of the enormous outpouring of aid to Asia is because Asia's kind of sexy in economic terms. Even the parts that are still poor, they're related to parts that are developing so quickly. And, you know, people feel like they're giving money to a region of the world that's on a real growth jag and very likely to continue. Part of that has been driven by aid. The U.S. very heavily involved in Japan, in Korea, elsewhere. But a lot of it seems homegrown. Take us deeper into the story of why Asia has managed to sort of step up here. Africa has not. Are you saying it's because of swampy jungles and bad agriculture? Is there a cultural element? How do you make this contrast?
Well, it's interesting that Asia is on a growth jag. It's one of the most important, decisive economic developments of the world. It is a world-changing phenomenon because the economic center of gravity in the 21st century is definitely moving to the Pacific and Asia, given the vast populations in Asia. But what's also interesting is when you line up governments according to perceptions of the quality of governance and corruption. Many listeners would be surprised to know that many African countries that have almost no economic growth rank much higher in quality of governance than many Asian countries that have very rapid economic growth.
So how have Asian countries been able to achieve that growth in spite of that corrupt government here and there?
Well, I think what we found is that there are many barriers to economic development in Africa, which are pretty pernicious, which are keeping Africa trapped, but which are solvable with directed resources.
And they're unique to Africa?
They are pretty much. We make an index of vulnerability based on transport costs, based on the ability to grow food reliably, based on disease ecology, in other words, where diseases are concentrated. Mm-hmm. And Africa by far tops the charts, not on how they're governing, but on the nature of the environment in which growth is to take place. I'll just give a few examples.
Yeah.
Malaria,
mm-hmm.
by far the worst in the world in Africa. That's a feature of the ecology, not of whether Africa is
right.
doing one thing or another.
Right.
Drought. Africa is a tropical and largely subhumid or arid environment. There aren't the great rivers that allow for mass irrigation as there are in China mm-hmm. or India or Pakistan. And what you have is rain-fed agriculture, highly vulnerable to periodic and, indeed, it seems, intensifying droughts.
So if the rain doesn't come, there's no river there, you're out of luck.
That's what happens when we hear about the Ethiopian famines.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost inevitably following a drought, and there's been an intensifying drought in places like Darfur, Sudan. In
mm-hmm.
fact, it's been 20 years of declining rainfall. A large part of Africa, ironically, lives in the interior of the continent, usually to try to find higher land, which is cooler, gets a bit more rainfall,
mm-hmm.
is more productive, places like Rwanda and Burundi.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the great ironies of population location in Africa. In incredibly poor people have become more concentrated in interior places where food production is better, but where it's almost impossible to get a foreign investor to come in to build a factory, for example.
Rwanda looks like a garden nation when you drive through it, but the population's so high and the income so low.
And it's 1,000 miles in the interior of the continent,
mm-hmm.
which means that the transport costs overland are absolutely horrendous. Now, what we're saying practically is, okay, let's hone down on these features because malaria, it's actually preventable and treatable if you have the resources to do it. Let's look at drought. Well, there are water management techniques, some old ones and some new ones that can make a huge difference. Soil fertility, there are, again, traditional and new approaches that can make a difference. Landlockedness can be overcome by paving some roads and building some roads. But what we say and what we find repeatedly is that while there are practical things that can be done, you have this ironic trap You're trapped. You're impoverished because of these barriers of drought, malaria, lack of irrigation, and so forth. There are practical investments you could make to overcome it. But because you're impoverished, you can't afford to make those investments.
Right.
And we're saying if the world would help to address those practical problems, that would lift these countries up to a point where they could then take over and start achieving their own economic growth as so many other parts of the world have.
And you're
saying focus on the barriers.
If this investment is made, the bad hand Africa's dealt environmentally that you're describing here can actually be overcome? I mean, are you envisioning a kind of middle-class Africa in the year 2050 on a par with something we see in India today? Is that achievable?
Well, let me take an example, which won't sound so glorious, but frankly, for a development economist looking at this is pretty glorious. That's the case of Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Bangladesh is an extremely poor country, but it's achieving significant economic growth. It used to be called a basket case. Nobody calls it a basket case now. There's actually a textile industry in Dhaka, Bangladesh, which employs about 1.5 million workers. It's recently been significantly upgraded. That's a country on the move. When women used to average 6 children per family, now that rate is down to 3 and still falling.
But you're talking a long way from Africa. I mean, India was once described this way, you know, what, 50 years ago?
It was, even less, just 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, the point is that these are poor countries, but they're on the ladder of economic development. And what I'm saying is Africa's not on the ladder of economic development. It's looking up at that ladder. It can't get the first foot on the rung because, my God, how do you start even the first foot when you have malaria, when you're hungry, when you're too far from a port, when you have these barriers that you know how to bridge that gap, but you need that stool to get up to the first rung of the ladder. Then you can start climbing, as so many other places have done. We are not saying that in 10 years you can create a middle-class continent. That's actually not the plan, and it's not possible. We're saying that you can help people escape from the poverty that is killing them day in, day out, and that the world seems to want to look away as the children are dying of malaria that could readily be prevented and treated.
Jeffrey Sachs, what would this look like? Let's say that miraculously, you propose it Monday morning and Monday afternoon the trigger is pulled and there's $150 billion there immediately for 2005, and you know it's going to be coming every year for the next 10, maybe 20 years. What would this effort look like? Would the continent of Africa be covered with white UN, land cruisers and, caterpillar bulldozers building an interstate highway system? Would there be foreigners all over the place? Would Africans do it? What would it feel like? What would it look like?
Well, it's a great question. And we're not saying, by the way, that you do this from one day to the next. We are saying, though, that you take a 10-year perspective and you plan to build up to that real effort. We're also not saying that the UN with its land cruisers is the one to do it, because it's the people themselves that are living there that, if they're empowered with the financial means or with the tools paid for by the financial help, that would do it. And I can give a very practical example. On Monday, I brought together in Nairobi the government leaders in the health sector in Kenya and the leading donors. And this is another epicenter of disease and early death. Now, what's clear is that with some targeted investments, malaria, AIDS, tuberculosis, mothers dying in childbirth, all of those crises could be addressed. And we actually laid out in that meeting a series of steps, getting bed nets to children to protect them from malaria, training clinical officers in the so-called sub-district hospitals to do cesarean sections, hiring 4,000 nurses that Kenya has trained but can't afford to hire because they don't have the budget resources of some few tens of millions of dollars to hire the nurses, despite the fact that every clinic and hospital in the country is crying out for nurses to take care of patients who are overloading the wards. So we laid out an absolutely straightforward, practical set of steps. Now, I said to the donors, are you ready to step up? And the answer is, well, we think we might be. You know, we're going to look at it. But the point of this meeting was to say to the Kenyan government, look, you want to do these things, you want to hire 4,000 nurses, you want to train clinical officers, you have to show very specifically how money coming in would be translated to those results. How are the bed nets really going to reach the children? But then I turned to the donors and said, look, you can argue all you want about governance and systems and so forth, but if the Kenyans deliver, do you really have the money to put into this to make the investment? Because otherwise it's all show, it's charade, it's talk. Mm-hmm. And it was to get both sides to focus on the real things, not the accusations, the mutual recriminations, the stereotypes and so forth. I think we made some headway. Now, this has to be done over and over again throughout the low-income world and in a variety of sectors. But the fact of the matter is that within 10 years, as has happened in many other places, the face of the African continent and other parts of the world could be changed by having children in school, properly fed, farmers growing a decent crop, and people not dying of diseases that yep. a small expense could actually treat.
We hear it. We're talking with Jeffrey Sachs about pulling the trigger on a huge effort to address global poverty. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Dovey is calling from Boston. Hi, Dovey. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Professor Sachs.
How are you?
I would like to congratulate Professor Sachs for taking this initiative and trying to shake the conscience and the minds of a lot of people about what's going on in Africa and the need to have a serious development effort to aid Africa.
And will it work, David? Are you confident if the resources were there, would it work?
That's a good question. I think it will work, but you have to be careful in where you're directing these resources to. And you have to also just do the basic, teach people what this is about. We have not had in the history of Africa a model as to what is a developed country in Africa. We never had that.
What about South Africa?
Well, South Africa, unfortunately, has been, first of all, it has been a counterexample of what should happen in that the resources there were monopolized by a minority that happened to be historically foreign to the continent. So when people look at South Africa from across the continent,
it's like a one-of-a-kind case in a way.
I'm sorry?
Looks like a one-of-a-kind case in a way.
Well, in a way. And also the question was, is this what you want a developed Africa to look like, a place where white people have access to all the resources and then the original inhabitants of the place are just sitting and watching?
That's a pretty arresting question if you're African, I hear
right.
you.
Right, and you ask yourself, and when you see, and it's interesting that earlier in your comments you mentioned the white UN trucks. What are those trucks symbolizing in a variety of places that they go to is this foreign assistance that basically comes in and goes, but that has no long-term plans and no long-term involvement.
It's not organic, not integral. Dovey, we've got it. We're coming up on a break. Jeffrey Sachs, your thoughts on Dovey's observation?
Well, absolutely right, emphatically on that last point. We have hardly helped Ethiopia in recent years, for example, to grow food. But then when the famine inevitably hits, because the farming system's so fragile, and then when the rains fail, the crop fails, then we pour in large amounts of money. And we do that every few years. It makes no sense. Let's get to the core of the problem so it isn't just this transitory response to the symptoms.
Monday in New York, Jeffrey Sachs will be with Kofi Annan. They'll be rolling out the Millennium Project for addressing poverty around the world. We're talking with him about that project, that enormous goal tonight. Why is once poor Asia now rocketing ahead while Africa is still losing ground? And does Jeffrey Sachs make a believer out of you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a daring, maybe a little bit desperate, grand strategy for ending global poverty. One of its creators swears this will finally work. We're talking tonight with global development evangelist Jeffrey Sachs. You can join the conversation as well. Does Jeffrey Sachs make a believer out of you? Is the world ready for a sustained new effort here? Or does it have to be shocked into giving, tsunami style? Will this work? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Melissa's calling from Swetsonville, North Carolina. Hi, Melissa. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, because I've been interested in development, economic development in a long time, and especially as it applies to to lending these countries money as opposed to just giving general aid.
So has Jeffrey Sachs got your engine revved up tonight? Does this sound like the way, finally, at last, break through with a big push and get it done?
Well, absolutely. And, in fact, I've been thinking about it since the turn of the millennium. There was an idea floated called Jubilee for, you know, kind of a general debt forgiveness for the poorest nations. And that, I mean, maybe it was too simplistic an answer, but it seemed like a very important part of the equation to forgive the giant debt load for countries that can't even, you know, produce enough to service the debt, much less put it into developing.
In the first place, let us pick it up, Melissa, and thanks for the call. Jeffrey Sachs, how does that fit in? The $150 billion a year, is that aid or lending? And what about accumulated debt already? Is there any move to wipe that off or not?
Yeah, Melissa's exactly right. The Jubilee 2000 was a big deal, and a lot of us worked hard to try to promote the concept that if you're already utterly impoverished and you need more help, don't be forced to pay debt instead. And a lot of the debt has been reduced or cut, but a lot still remains. So part of what we're recommending is indeed to wipe off the debts of the very poorest countries of the world. But that is a little bit less radical these days than it sounds, because the finance ministers of the G7, the richest countries, have also endorsed that finally. It took them a long time to do it, but they have come to that.
And the big money you're talking about pushing, is that lending or is that grant aid?
Well, it is grants, but I should say one thing about the huge amounts. What we're asking for is actually nothing more than we've already promised, although it's not a promise that's very well known here. The United States and other countries repeatedly have said that they would make concrete efforts to give 0.7% of our national incomes to the official development assistance. In other words, that we would give a little bit less than 1% of our income to the poor for the purpose of development. But instead of 0.7%, the United States gives 0.15%, or to put it in easier to understand terms, we give 15 cents out of every $100 of our income for this purpose. But the target internationally or globally is 70 cents. We're not talking about breaking the bank here. We're not talking about efforts that even come close to what we're spending in Iraq each year right now. We're talking about a modest investment, roughly about 50 cents out of every $100 of our income on average during the next decade. 50 cents out of every $100 of our income.
It's just a heck of a lot bigger than what the country has mustered. Not the promise, but the actual will to actually
do. That's exactly right. It's bigger than we've done. But it's actually much less than most Americans think we're doing all the time. In the opinion surveys, time and again, Americans say that we're giving about a quarter of our national budget for these purposes, when in fact the truth is we're giving less than 1% of our budget.
We've got it.
Less than 1% of our income.
I want to hear from our callers here. Charlie is calling from Boston. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm an economist, an old friend of Jess, as a matter of fact, but I want to endorse what he's saying and add one point to it.
Yes, sir.
There is a lot in the private sector that is willing to step up to Africa on straight business kind of operations that are being frustrated by inability to get things going in the financing community or out of Washington. I'll give you two examples. I'm currently trying to work in the Gambia and also Senegal.
Okay.
In Gambia, we are trying to do an emergency fix to the lack of energy by bringing in barges that have mounted power plants on them as a first step in putting together an electric system.
And you want to do this as a profit-making operation, Charlie?
Well, not a hell of a lot of profit, but as a commercial operation.
A business, yeah.
Absolutely. And to get people to finance it, they look at you and laugh, say, West Africa? Nobody puts money in West Africa. The other one is a more fundamental one, and what Jeff was speaking of, is a what I call an agricultural development bank, but it's really a short-term, six-month lending so that the peanut farmers can borrow money to buy seed, and that the people after the harvest can borrow the money to buy the crops to process them downstream.
Sounds reasonable.
That bank does not exist in the Gambia. It does not exist in Senegal.
Yeah.
I said, we can do that. All we need is some backing from one of the agencies and getting some private money in there. Laugh at me. They say it'll never happen.
What if the Millennium Project should be embraced by the world and this money would start flowing? Could that turn all that around, Charlie? Are banks so opposed that even if there's big aid money flowing, they won't do it? Or would that change the climate?
In our case, all we need is somebody to step up and guarantee the loans to the banks.
Sounds like $150 billion a year might turn attitudes there in a hurry. Charlie, thanks for that very vivid illustration. Jeffrey Sachs, your buddy Bono, you too, says, we have the cash, we have the drugs, we have the science, but do we have the will? Do we have the will to make poverty history? You know, you're an economist, and then you became a guru, and now I have to say I look at you as a kind of evangelist. How's it selling, Jeffrey Sachs, the evangelist? Do you feel the will rising to this challenge? It's an exciting idea. Is the will there?
Well, I hope it's an evangelist with the evidence, because what I'm really trying to suggest is how practical all of this really is. And I feel, as I talk around the United States, that there is a tremendous will. That's why we had this great outpouring for the tsunami victims, because Americans are generous. They want to help. But they've been told a lot of things. They've been told there's nothing more we can do. It's all corruption. The reason Africa's poor is they mismanage. They don't hear about the malaria. They don't hear about the droughts. They don't hear about the difficulties of infrastructure that Charlie was just talking about. It was nice to hear from him. They don't hear about the practicalities. They also believe that we're already doing everything we possibly could do, because we like to pat ourselves on the back. We don't like to hear actually that we're not quite living up to all those commitments that we've made. So when these things are explained, I find a tremendous resonance, but they're so rarely explained, and it's very hard for people to cut through all the fog. The Wall Street Journal said a couple of weeks ago in an editorial, oh, the United States gives tens of billions of dollars in private giving. That's where it comes. Completely erroneously saying what Americans do. What they did, Tom? They counted remittances from workers here to their families at home as part of America's foreign assistance.
House cleaners kind of sending their bucks back to El Salvador.
Exactly. A little bit shocking, shockingly irresponsible.
Well, it doesn't sound like you're looking to calculate it that way. We wish you luck with your big unveiling on Monday, and thanks for the foretaste tonight. Good luck with everything, Jeffrey Sachs. Always good
talking to you. Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Jeffrey Sachs, he is director of Columbia University's Earth Institute. Look for the big news on Monday when the UN unveils its Millennium Development Project. He's right at the heart of it. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, Britain up in arms over a royal gaffe. This is On Point. It is a royal embarrassment, to say the least. Britain's Prince Harry, third in line to the British throne, wore a Nazi swastika armband to a swanky costume party. This morning, it was front-page news in Britain. One newspaper's headline, Harry the Nazi. The prince's wardrobe brought widespread condemnation across Britain and around the world. Robert Rosette is library director at the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial Center in Jerusalem.
We would hope that figures like Prince Harry would be more sensitive to the issue and would not wear Nazi uniforms or in other ways trivialize the history of the Holocaust.
There was also condemnation from members of the British military. Doug Henderson, former British Armed Forces Minister, cast doubt on Prince Harry's qualifications to attend Sandhurst, the elite British military academy he's scheduled to join.
I think if he was anyone else, he would make himself ineligible for membership at Sandhurst because he's displayed characteristics that are unacceptable.
Jennifer Hughes is a reporter for the Financial Times and joins me now from New York. She's been following all the latest developments. Jennifer, how do you characterize the UK's response, first of all, to Prince Harry's costume?
Well, I have to say that, you know, royal gaffe such as this is not exactly a core FT story, but of course we're all aware of what's going on. I mean, if you look at the headlines, we're seeing renegade royal, rebel prince, enfant terrible. I mean, it's made the front page now of pretty much every single newspaper across the world, from what I can tell. It was foolish. It was stupid. There's no doubt about that. And incredibly insensitive, given the timing coming up towards the anniversary of Auschwitz.
This is the liberation of prisoners from Auschwitz just a couple of weeks from now, the 60th anniversary.
Yes, that's right. Prince Edward, Harry's uncle, is going to be attending that ceremony. I know a lot of the Jewish groups have actually called for him to attend the ceremony, you know, to atone for what he's done.
Mm-hmm.
But Clarence House has actually said it would be a distraction and would detract from the ceremony.
Clarence House is?
Clarence House is Prince Charles, Harry's father's royal residence.
I see. Talk to us about Prince Harry for a minute. He's had a kind of a troubled go here. At least that's the way it looks from the newspapers. Is it fair? Is this a kid who's somehow strayed off the path?
Well, it does begin to look that way. A few years back, he got in trouble for smoking marijuana. And since then, he's had scuffles with photographers. He's been pictured smoking and drinking heavily. He has been in Argentina a while back working on a ranch, and British papers had nothing, but Argentine papers were focusing a lot on his carousing and local bars. So he has a little bit of a reputation, you know, the rebel prince, the renegade royal. They're common names for him in the UK at the moment.
And what do you make of this whole party? It was at the home of a triple Olympic gold medalist, friend of... the family, Prince William, was also there. The theme was colonials and natives, already kind of an odd throwback. And then Prince Harry, who's had a pretty fancy education at Eton, showing up with a swastika on his arm. Can you paint the picture of the bubble around him or the culture in the UK or whatever it might be that would lead him to think, oh, this would be funny?
I can only say that it was a very stupid, misguided thing. As soon as I saw the headlines this morning, it winced. It was incredibly foolish and insensitive. The whole theme, colonials and natives, does seem a bit like that. Remember that Prince William's own birthday party a couple of years back was themed out of Africa. Now, he's always had a love and a fascination for that continent, and as far as we know, that was all in very good taste. William this time actually turned up wearing black leggings and some sort of lion outfit. It would have been quite entertaining to see photos of that, I guess.
Mm.
But yes, the social set Harry hangs around with from what you can tell in the newspapers, is very upper class, very privileged, and quite cushioned from everyday life.
Now, of course, the entire royal family there has got a kind of history. Duke of Windsor, 1937, visited Germany with Mrs. Simpson as the personal guest of Hitler. So it's sort of back there. It must make it, in history, it must make it doubly painful for his family now.
Well, as you can see, all the newspapers have been pulling this stuff out. Of course, the royal family itself is part German, which, of course, has been mentioned numerous times today. I think the best way of characterizing this is a very stupid gaffe, and we're given to believe that Prince Harry has been roundly told off by his family for this sort of behavior, that this was a big gaffe, and, of course, because of the family's history and because of Britain's history with Germany as well, it's made the story bigger than it would have otherwise been, perhaps.
He said today, it was a poor choice of costume, and I apologize, that somehow seems slight. Do you expect more in the way of contrition or atonement here, or is that it?
Well, that's all the royal family are saying for now. I see the Prime Minister has also decided to sidestep this one. There's been a lot of calls for more, and we'll have to see. If the row goes on for a few days, I suspect the family might be forced into saying more, and Harry may have to say something personally.
Jennifer Hughes, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jennifer Hughes, a reporter for the Financial Times. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Rachel Dornhelm, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.